Welcome to the Black College Sports and Education Foundation weekly podcast, where we equip students, athletes, their families, and supporters with vital tools and information that will impact their decisions on educational opportunities and careers. Tune in every Thursday night at 7 Eastern Standard Time as we host prominent guests from a variety of backgrounds, such as education, sports, medicine, and the corporate world. Remember, the Black College Sports and Education Foundation is your one-stop resource center. Now here's your host, Gil McGregor.
Hello, everybody. This is Gil McGregor, and welcome to Black College Sports and Education Foundation's podcast. You know, we've had some great guests in our podcast prior to today. Today is no different in terms of it being a great guest, but it's a little bit different in terms of the kind of guests we have. We've talked to Willis Reed. We've talked to Nate Tiny Archibald. We've talked to Sam Jones, but we haven't talked to a person who's been an athletic director at HBCU, who's been an assistant commissioner at one of the top sports conferences in the country, the ACC. And, you know, I've had a chance to meet one other athlete who's been on the Wheaties box, but this is the second one that I had a chance to meet. Now, the first one that I had a chance to meet and talk about, you probably know that person by the name of Michael Jordan. But I've got another one for you today. Been on the Wheaties box. Been involved with the U.S. Olympic team. So we're talking about greatness personified. Everybody, welcome today, Ms. Dee Todd. Dee, thank you for being a guest on our podcast.
Thank you so much. And I just have one quick correction, Gil. I was on the Kellogg's cornflakes box.
Excuse me. I guess I said
I think everybody assumes Wheaties because cornflakes. That's the one you think of, an athlete, yes.
Well, I grew up with the cornflakes and the bananas and the sugar, and it was pretty good. Well, since we start there, let's just stay there because there's other things that you've done that we're going to talk about that probably have a little more gravity than that, but that's got to be, D, something that, I mean, you're a young athlete, and you saw Michael's picture, and then somebody would say, well, I sure hope I can get – how did that happen? How did you deal with it? How did that make you feel?
Well, you know what? I have been kind of a naive person all my life. Things just hit me in the head, and then I say, oh, that's pretty cool. But I never aspired to be on a cereal box. I was actually teaching and coaching in the Chicago area. And I had been doing some professional modeling for an agency that happened to have Kellogg's as an account. So I had been on some of their print ads, and I guess one day the people from Battle Creek called my agent and said, hey, you know, we'd like to put her on a Kellogg's cornflakes box. Well, I thought that was okay. So when I went for the photo shoot and they started making me up, and I'm like, I don't look like this when I coach. You know, they had me with the Supreme Bouffant haircut and, you know, all that kind of thing. And they had a hard time dealing with photographing food because they were filling the bowls of cereal with milk and the Kellogg's and putting some strawberries on. Well, after two or three shots, then it would get moist and, you know,
soggy.
And so somebody in there had a bright idea of emptying a whole bottle of Elmer's glue into a bowl and putting the cornflakes on top of the Elmer's glue, put the strawberries on top, and then cover it in shellac. So needless to say, I'm smiling and inhaling this shellac and Elmer's glue. That it was kind of fun. When the box came out, it was fun, but I just never knew that I was the first Black female on the box. And I would go in grocery stores, and of course I was teaching and coaching down at Thornton Ridge High School, I believe, in South Side of Chicago, and my kids would go in, and the boxers would come in, and they'd buy them all up, and it was kind of fun. I think it took off more as I grew older when people started looking back and saying, oh, you won the cereal box. And then it kind of hit me, like, you know, probably something pretty cool. So I've had a lot of fun with it.
You and Michael Jordan, different boxes, but still, you with Winston-Salem State University around as your background as far as North Carolina is concerned. And, of course, the iconic Michael Jordan from the state of North Carolina. But let's talk about that young lady who ran track in Camden, New Jersey. Tell us about that.
Well, again, that was something that wasn't necessarily spectacular. I came from the pre-Title IX era, and it was called Girls AA, Girls Athletic Association. And we had really no coaches. I did get a chance to participate in the pen relays in high school, but again, that was right across the bridge from where I grew up in Camden.
But still, everybody doesn't participate in the pen relays, not just across the street from where you grew up. You had to have some ability or you don't get to be in the pen relays. Isn't that right?
Well, you know, Gil, I just really don't remember. I'm assuming that we had to have a mark and we probably paid a small entry fee. And I just don't remember. But I do remember getting to participate both in 65 and 66, which was probably around the first years that they started letting girls participate in independent relays. And it was fun, and it was across the bridge.
Okay.
Camden, New Jersey. And, you know, I just went from there. But most of my focus was on cheerleading in high school because that was about all you could do. I did play basketball, but it wasn't, like I said, it was girls AA. And that was when we had the 3-on-3. You could only bounce, I don't know if it's 3-on-3, but you could only bounce the ball 3 times unless you were roving forward and you could cross the line. And I was one that you could cross the line. I was the only person that could cross the line. And I remember that. And we had these long skirts and knee-high socks. We had so many clothes on, it wasn't even funny.
Well, now, crossing the line, it seems ironic that you emphasized that. And I think that you talked about your career after high school wasn't right away college. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. I was a pretty good roller skater. And in New Jersey, everybody kind of skates. And roller derby was bringing a team to Philadelphia. And they came over to the skating rink that I used to skate at. And they picked some people to come to Philadelphia and learn how to skate on the bank track. And I was one that they selected. So I went over and they actually let me sign up and be a part. And I was going to be on the team, but they were just getting started and they wanted everyone who was going to be on the team to sign a 2-year, pretty much like a contract guarantee that you would stay. And for some reason, I just wasn't feeling that, and I didn't want to do it. So they allowed me to stay, but pretty much on the practice team, and I would get in a match every now and then. But I did that for 2 years and decided that, oh, I think I better go to college because I was college prep in high school, and I didn't have any skills. I was working in a factory in Camden. I worked for RCA, and they were building radios. And that's what I did. And I'm thinking, this is not the life I want to live. So I worked at RCA, skated in the afternoon, and I just, for some reason, didn't see that that was going anywhere. And so all of a sudden, I decided, I think I better go to college. Well, I was going to go to Cheney.
Okay.
Because you think about the schools that you hear of. And being in New Jersey, I had already taken some classes at Rutgers, Camden. I knew of Temple, and I knew of Cheney. And at that time, Cheney was experiencing some accreditation issues, and they didn't know if they were going to close it down or what. Didn't know anything about colleges in North Carolina, but a guy that I happened to be dating was from Martinsville, Virginia. And he said, you know, I had two sisters that went to this school, Winston-Salem State, and it's only about, you know, 50 miles from Martinsville, I think he said. He said, you should look into that. So I started looking into that, and I also looked at Bennett, and then I found out that Bennett was all girls, and that didn't interest me. So long story short, I ended up coming to Winston-Salem State, sight unseen.
Wow.
That was the beginning. I had never seen it, never heard of it, or anything. And I was 20 years old when I got there. So I was a little older, you know, than the most freshmen coming in and had worked and, you know, done a few things So it was a different experience, but it's one that I will never regret.
I think it's so interesting, Dee, that, you know, you ran track as a young girl. You get your picture on the Kellogg's cornflakes box. So you obviously had that visible type of allure. And then you're throwing elbows in the roller derby. I mean, talk about well-rounded. Now, once you get to Winston-Salem State, was it there that the administrative aspect of sports kicked in for you? What did you major in? How did you get pointed in that direction and when?
Well, when I went to Winston-Salem State, I didn't really know what I wanted to do because, as you know, back then, Winston-Salem State was primarily a teacher's college.
That's what they called it, TC.
Called it TC, and then it went to Winston-Salem State College, and before I left, it became a university. Well, I decided, well, let me try early childhood education. Maybe I'll just teach kids. Knowing good and well that I didn't like little kids. So we had some kind of session where we would have these kids come in from the local elementary schools, and we were supposed to do these little workshops. Well, that was the first semester I was there, and it was at that point where I said, you know, this is not for me. And so I changed to health, physical education, and recreation because I always liked sports. So I said, I'll do that. And also, I had a minor in biology and grew to like the biology a lot. So I took enough classes that I actually ended up having a double major with PE and biology. And little did I know that that was going to help me later in life. So I came to Winston-Salem, decided to go out for cheerleading, which was what I had most of my experience in. And Coach Big House Gaines kind of liked me because he always said I was very driven and knew what I wanted. So he kind of liked that little spunk in me. He used to call me Slick.
Okay.
Yeah. He said, yeah, you slick. You're going to get what you want. And so when I went out for cheerleading as a freshman, I had signed up for work study. So he decided, well, since you like to run things, I'm going to make you captain of the cheerleaders. And that way, that's going to be your work study. You keep them all straight.
So wow.
I became captain of the cheerleading at Winston-Salem State as a freshman. And continue that throughout my senior year.
You know, it's so interesting because we've had Coach Gaines' son on, and we've had Teddy Blunt, and we've had Cleo Hill Jr., and the influence, again, of Coach Big House Gaines, even in your athletic beginnings, it's just something else to marvel because he seemed to have had his influence and his spirit everywhere. Not just at Winston-Salem State.
He was wonderful. And I do think that I was probably one of the first females that he actually kind of took an interest in because one of his star players was my boyfriend and actually ended up being my husband, was Alan McManus.
Okay.
And he was from Charlotte. And he used to call himself Keeping Up With Me so he could keep up with Matt.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
And so he told me one time, he said, now, you know, that's the Southern boy. You know, you're going to get too fast for him. You need to watch out. So he liked the fact that I was very driven and that I was a little bit older. And I made sure that I handled my studies. And I ended up, had the highest cumulative average in education department for 2 years at Winston-Salem. And I did my work. And so he liked that. I worked in his office, and he would sit down and talk to me and call me Slick and whatever other names he could call me. I was thinking, if Coach Gaines didn't call you something ugly, he didn't like you.
He's ignoring you.
He did not like you. He wasn't calling you something. And I actually babysat it for Clarence and Lisa.
You and Teddy Blunt, because that was one of the things that Clarence Jr. said. He said, I know Teddy was his favorite basketball player because he let Teddy babysit us, and he wouldn't let any knucklehead babysit his kids. So you were high on the list if you got to babysit
them. Yep, I babysat it. And Clarence won't admit it, but Lisa remembers.
Okay.
Because I would always try to do Lisa's hair. I was never good at doing hair. And she'd be walking out the street looking all crazy because I had done her hair. But, yeah, Coach Gaines kind of stayed in my life forever and until his passing. And as a matter of fact, I was on the committee when they were bringing back the Hall of Fame. And I was the one that suggested that they name that Hall of Fame after him. And that was met with some resistance because they didn't feel that, you know, why should we name the Hall of Fame after someone? And I said, well, first of all, the CIAA Hall of Fame is named after John McLendon.
Yes.
And I said, and Coach Gaines was the most recognizable name from Winston-Salem State. So it just made sense to me that the Hall of Fame should be named after him. And, of course, it ended up going to that. And I'm just very proud of that. But I can't take originality for the idea because I was already in the CIAA Hall of Fame. And I knew that it was named after John McLendon.
There are other great historic black athletic names in your history. I understand that your uncle was Dr. Leroy Walker.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I happen to have had the pleasure of getting to know him and to be around him. Not a lot, but very, very fortunate the time that I did spend around him. Give us a little insight to having D. Leroy Walker as an uncle.
Well, he was at North Carolina Central as the track coach when I was at Winston-Salem. And, you know, we would kind of see each other and so forth. We didn't have track for women, but I got to work and be a part of the first Pan-African meet that he brought to Duke, I believe it was. And from that point on, every school that I taught, I coached track at, high school, college, whatever, he would come visit me and stay a couple of days, and we would go out on the track, and he would walk around, and he would, you know, tell this kid to do this and that kid to do that. And I walked behind him like a sponge. I tried to soak up every single thing that he said because he had a way of coaching and explaining things that just made so much sense. And he could break down an event and tell you exactly, you know, how you should run a curve, how you should do whatever. And I even find myself, even now as I'm coaching track in high school, I find myself saying the exact same things that he said. So when he was president of the U.S. Olympic Committee, and you know he was the first and only black president of the Olympic Committee, he decided to have two committees to get more women and minorities involved in the volunteerism and the Olympic movement. And he picked me to chair the task force on minorities, and another lady named Sandy Knapp to be chair of the task force for women. Together, she and I came up with a program called Project Gold. And what Project Gold meant was guaranteed Olympic leadership development.
Okay.
And, well, the USOC gave us, I believe, $100,000 for the program, and we went out and found Eli Lilly, who matched it, giving us $200,000. So we were able to, instead of recruiting 50, we were able to recruit 100 people, 50 minorities, 50 women, and bring them into Colorado Springs for a 3 or 4 day training session and teaching them about volunteerism, how the Olympic movement was, how everything worked. And I'm just really proud to say that a lot of those people are doing great things now.
That's outstanding.
You think about Stephanie Hightower, you think about Ward Manuel, who's the AD at Michigan, Craig Littlepage, who's a longtime AD at Virginia.
Yes.
We had some great people that ended up doing some wonderful things. We had the first African-American mayor of New Orleans on our group. We got to meet a lot of people. Morial, I believe.
Mark Morial, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And he was in our program. Bernadette McGlade, who is now the commissioner of the Atlantic 10, she was in our program. Stephanie Hightower, who is now the U.S. representative for the IAAF in track and field, she was in our program. And I could just go on and on about, you know, him putting me into that position to get to know all of these people.
Now, so, when did you get to Northwestern, Dee? How long after this situation was it before you got down to go to Northwestern?
Actually, I was at Northwestern before the USOC.
Okay,
I was at Northwestern from 1981 to 1986. 5, I believe.
Okay.
And I was coaching in high school in the Chicago suburbs, and at that time is when women started to go toward the NCAA versus the old AIAW. So a lot of schools were trying to change over to the NCAA, and they were hiring, you know, coaches. So I used to coach a summer camp down at the University of Illinois, and that is where I first met Jackie Joyner. She was like a sophomore in high school, and she was at the camp. And this one year I was at the camp, and the coach from Illinois said, you know, Northwestern is getting ready to hire a track coach. And she said, I think you should apply. Well, I had just gotten a condo on the entire south side of Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, just signed a lease, and Northwestern was on the entire north side. And so I said, oh, heck, I'll go for it. So I applied, and the person that was doing the hiring was Ted Leland, who went on to be the longtime athletic director at Stanford. And at the time, I had my cornflakes box was out. I had been one of the 5 women that introduced Fashion Fair Cosmetics. So it was like a big blowout in Ebony featuring each one of us. And I just had a lot of things going on. I was a successful high school coach. And I went up to interview with Ted Leland. And when I walked in, I remember him saying, I don't believe you're a coach, because we don't have coaches that look like this. And he said, but if it wasn't for the fact that you have Dr. Leroy Walker,
yes, ma'am,
as one of your references, then we have got to take a look at you. And long story short, they offered me the job, and I commuted to Northwestern every day, which took me anywhere from an hour and 15 minutes to, depending on what the weather was like, 3 or 4 hours.
Wow.
To get there. And they had just hired Dennis Green.
Okay.
To coach football. And Dennis and I became the only 2 African Americans that were head coaches at the same predominantly white institution.
That's great.
And they actually just did a story in the Daily Northwestern about a couple months ago about barriers that the NCAA had placed on African Americans in getting into coaching. And I didn't know that in the history of Northwestern, I am the only female that's African-American female that's ever been a head coach at Northwestern in its history. And even worse than that, there's only been 5 of us total, 5 African-Americans total in the history of Northwestern.
That's that was great. Dennis, it's not great that it's only 5, but it's great that you're 1 of the 5.
Yeah, I'm 1 of the 5, but it was only 5. And that was Dennis Green, Francis Pay, both of them were football, Ricky Birdsong was basketball, myself in track, and the guy that's there now is the baseball coach.
Wow.
And that is all that has ever been a head coach at Northwestern.
Dee, after Northwestern, what is the path that led to the Atlantic Coast Conference? That's the conference I played in. That's the conference I'm most familiar with. But what was the path that led you there?
Well, what led me there was, unfortunately, I ended up getting a divorce, and I was looking for a new start. And through a couple things of seeing some people at a track meet at Georgia Tech, and Georgia Tech did not have a women's track program. And again, people were still trying to add women's track. Long story short, I ended up getting the head job at Georgia Tech, which made me the first African-American to be a head coach in the ACC.
Okay.
And that was back in 1985. And the person that was the athletic director that hired me was Dr. Homer Rice.
Yes, yes.
And he hired me, and he put me out there, and I stayed there for 3 years, you know, got coach of the year after the second year of the program, and gave them their first All-Americans, but I just wasn't making the salary that I needed to make, because now I'm a single parent, and I needed to get a little more. And the ACC was beginning to expand their office, and it was due a lot to NCAA grant money. So the NCAA had come up with these conferences saying, okay, we're going to give you grant money to do women's basketball, drug education, compliance, and we're going to give you a little bit of money for minority enhancement. So I had gone to the ACC track meet. It was at Duke. And John McCrone, who's now the commissioner of the Horizon Conference, was assistant commissioner of the ACC. And he came over to me and he said, look, you know, I came over here to see you because we are expanding our office. And he explained what an assistant commissioner would do and so forth, because I didn't know anything about the operations or anything. If it didn't run, jump, hurdle, or throw, I really didn't know about
okay,
it.
Okay.
And so he said, we want to hire Jane Corrigan. One of the jobs wants to hire a woman for the championship job. He wants to hire someone that had been a coach. He said, I think you would be great for the championship job. And so I came in to interview, and the 40% of that job was to build women's basketball.
Okay.
And again, I'm a track person, but, you know, I felt like it wasn't something I couldn't learn, but I was going to be in charge of all the championships except for men's basketball, which Fred Barraquette was doing. So I came there and I got dumped every sport that the ACC had. I actually oversaw that sport on the conference level.
Wow.
And, but my main focus was women's basketball. And I have to thank Fred Barraquette because he took me under his wing and showed me, you know, how he ran the men's basketball tournament. And I would see things that the men had that the women didn't have. And I would go back and say, well, why don't the women have this? And why are the men playing in these great facilities and the women are playing in a, you know, less than up to par facility? So I just started to get on their nerves.
Okay.
And just fighting, you know, how come women got T-shirts and keychains and men were getting televisions, you know, for gifts?
ID, was Title IX on the horizon, or was it in place, or how does that fit into what you're talking
about? Title IX was kind of, but nobody paid it a lot of attention. And so it wasn't until, I would say, the early 90s that Title IX, you know, just kind of blew up because they appointed people to be on what they called a gender equity committee. And I was one of the people that was appointed, and it probably was 20-some of us. And what we were to do was to define what did gender equity mean? What was Title IX really supposed to mean? And so that's how that committee came up with how you judge schools or how you measure schools to see if they were fulfilling the purpose of Title IX. And that is pretty much what's in place now. And what we did was came up with three prongs to measure. The first prong was proportionality. And according to Title IX, you should be within 5% opportunities in athletics per your undergraduate enrollment. So if you had, say, 55% females at your undergrad enrollment and 45% males, then at least 50% of your athletic opportunities should go to females.
Okay. Okay.
And then the second prong was history. Did you as a university or athletic department had a history of adding women's sports as you could? You know, did you were constantly trying to add? And I don't know that was the second or third. The other one was interest. So if you had a group of people, if you had, say, club volleyball, and the club volleyball girls came to the AD and said, hey, we want to be in a sport, you know, a varsity sport, then you had to add that because you had an interest. So that went haywire for a while because it got a lot of people up in arms because the problem with that was that football counted
yes.
in the numbers.
Yes.
And because football counted in the numbers, you didn't have a women's sport that gave you those numbers. And so, unfortunately, a lot of men's sports got hurt, i.e. track, swimming, wrestling, even baseball in some instances. So schools were dropping men's sports, which I don't think was ever the intention of the committee, but they were dropping men's sports to add women's sports. And so that caused, you know, a little friction. People were kind of angry about Title IX.
And still now there's, you know, I guess the one thing that used to come up to was the basketball coach has got this kind of office and he's getting this kind of salary. And the woman's coach has this kind of office and this kind of salary, although people weren't necessarily coming to the women's basketball games. And so that was some of the argument, too, that
That's got to be an issue, and particularly when you had like sports. But I don't think a lot of people understood that it wasn't necessarily the salary. It was things like, is your locker room comparable? Is your means of transportation comparable? So if you're going to the same site and the men are flying and the women are going on the bus, not comparable. You know, if you're playing in a really major facility and the women are playing in the gym, that's not comparable. So gender equity meant a lot more than salary.
What I find so interesting is that you took your voice to a national level from Winston-Salem State University. That's still the bottom line in terms of what we do here at the foundation is try to show young people that out of HBCUs come genius, come athletic genius, come scientific genius, educational genius. And now the idea of, I don't know if it's going to be anything that we'll one day put down in the archives of what we're doing, but you're our first female podcast. You're the very first woman that we've had on. And not that we were trying to vet to see who was going to be the first, but it just so happens that you are. And I know that you've been the first a lot of places. And so I hope that this becomes one of your memories of being the first.
You know, it seems like every single job that I have had, I was either the first female or the first minority, and most of the time, both.
Yes.
And I guess in my mind, I felt like I always had to do a good job. Not that I would think any other way, but I always felt like if I messed up, I was going to mess up opportunities for other people that looked like me. And my goal was to always reach out and reach back and bring people along with me because I just feel there's room at the top for everybody. You know, you work hard, you do what you need to do. I never felt like I would get to a certain place and that I didn't want anybody else there. I always have always brought people along with me. And I feel like that is my, I won't say claim to fame, but to me that's what I feel the most good about is the fact that I have been able to impact and influence lives, not even thinking about it. It's just I do it.
At the high school level now as a coach, what is it that you're emphasizing to the young people whose minds and whose attention and whose bodies that you have charge of so many hours of the day?
Well, young people nowadays, the millennium age, they're very different. But I am old school, and I tell them from day one, I'm old and I'm old school. And I'm teaching them things like being responsible, making good decisions, not making excuses for things that they feel they can't do. And I teach them what I call the three C's. I said, you know, your whole life is based on three C's, choice, chance, and change. And you are the only person that can control those. And I don't allow them to make excuses. And I constantly tell them old stories. Now, I know a lot of them kind of look at me like I'm crazy. But invariably, in 2 or 3 years, you know, those kids will come back and they say, you know what, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. So I haven't changed much, except I may have changed the way I do some things. And so I'm still old school. I still believe in being responsible. I still believe in being on time. I still believe in the basic things that I had to grow up with and that I had to be responsible for. And I teach them that. And I also, you know, I kind of stay on parents. I'm like, look, let's not make excuses for them. These kids have got to learn. And that's the biggest problem that I find today is a lot of the parents. You know, they want to do everything for the kids. And, you know, we used to call them helicopter parents,
yes,
where they hover
yes.
around and try to see everything. Well, now I call them lawnmower parents. They just flat out want to mow the grass so you don't even trip.
Lawnmower parents, okay.
I think being older and having experiences that I have, some parents may not necessarily like it, but they eventually buy into it when they see how their kids turn out. And I'm most proud of that. I still stick with my old self. I just, you know, you just kind of have to change the way you hear things and what the kids are doing and the social media and stuff like that. I mean, they teach me a lot of things because I was still into making copies of an itinerary and handing them a piece of paper. And so one of them said to me, you know, Coach, you can screenshot this and put it on the Remind. I'm like, really?
Okay.
And so, I mean, I was wondering why I would give them two sheets, one for you and one for your parents. And then at the end of the practice, half the sheets were left on the bleachers.
Yes, indeed. Let's give a shout out to your high school. Let's give a shout out to your team. Where do you
yeah.
coach?
Heritage High School, Wake Forest, North Carolina.
All right.
Yep.
You're the Heritage High School. What's your mascot?
They are the Huskies.
The Huskies, the Heritage High School Huskies. All right.
In Wake Forest, North Carolina. And we are still a relatively new school. I think we are going, this year is year number 10 that the school has been open. And I am going into year number 6 with actually coaching the team. And I can honestly say that every record on the record board for all of the events for the women, every record except for one, kids were coached on my team. And now I do have the boys as well, and we're steadily chipping away
okay.
the men's records.
Well, do any of them know anything about Winston-Salem State University? Have they heard?
Oh, yeah. But, of course, no, we don't have a men's program at Winston-Salem State. And then on the women's side, they have had some issues with coaches. So we haven't been able to send anyone there. Unfortunately, one of the young men that I taught had signed a baseball letter of intent at Winston-Salem. And he was a Caucasian boy, and he was always wearing his Winston-Salem baseball shirt on. And then they, you know, dropped the program, and I was really sad about that because he was probably, you know, wearing his Winston-Salem State baseball shirt. And so I haven't been able to send people there. I think that it's going through a transition where athletics is steadily coming back, hopefully.
Okay, okay.
There is a young man that, I don't know if he graduated or not, but he had come from Heritage High School, and he had a brother that was a great player at Heritage, graduated last year. And he had a sister that I had recruited for track, and she actually came out one year. And she could have been really, really a good athlete, but she preferred cheerleading. So
that sounds like somebody else I know that did all right. So maybe she's going to be on the Calhoun's box one day. You never
well,
know.
You know, that's when there weren't other choices. That's the thing, you know. And I actually have nothing against cheerleading, but there's so many opportunities for young ladies in sports.
Great.
At the next level.
Great.
That I try to encourage them to look for those opportunities. And I've got some kids that go to schools and they know that they probably wouldn't do well at that level. But the lessons that they have taken from being on our track team have been invaluable. And they still come back. As soon as they get a break from college, I look up and 7, 8 of them walking down the hill to see you. I'm like,
that's so
you would
cool.
think. It's pretty cool. You would think, I said, I thought I got rid of you last year. No, coach. Let me ask you this. Were we like this? And yes, you were. But I've always loved young people. I've always loved being able to make a difference with them. And a lot of it is through tough love. I baby them, but I think this is a time where being an older woman is an advantage. I'm able to keep up with them. But I'm also able to give them some insight on some things that some of the younger coaches probably can't do.
Well, did you say it's chance, choice, and change? Is that what you
mm-hmm.
said?
Chance, choice, and change.
That is outstanding, those three pillars that you talked about. we have some programming ourselves here at the foundation, one we call CPEP, where we try to come in to high schools and actually junior high and start talking to young people about it. If you want to go off to college, if you want to go on past high school, we got some things for you to think about, some things to look at, to start talking about courses that you take to prepare them mentally for moving on past high school. And knowing that there are people like yourself, Dee, who can give them the role models based on race, based on ethnicity, based on gender, and based on accomplishment. The people that you've known, the things that you've done, we are so pleased that you took the time to spend with us today on our podcast and that you are the first female, but you're setting some high standards for the next ones that's going to follow you being on our program. And we can't tell you how much it has meant to us to have had you as our guest today.
Well, I certainly appreciate that. And, you know, that gives me an idea. I would love to be involved in helping you get that word out to young people as you are.
Oh, that's what I hoped you were going to say, Dee.
Yeah, I would love to be able to do that.
Well, if you would take the time, and we want everybody who's listening to you and listening to us to go to our website, BC Sports Foundation. We've got some programs there. We got policies there. We got our mission statement there. And we have the opportunity to ask people to reach out and help us with the people they know. You've called some names of some folks. One, we'd like to have a couple of them on our podcast. We'd like to have those people look at what we're doing and see how they can participate. There's a lot of ways to help, funding ways, ideas, contacts. And what our bottom line has always been is we're trying to help keep HBCU doors open. And that's what we want to do. We want to solicit folks like yourself to help us do so.
Well, it was a wonderful experience to go to an HBCU. As I said, I wouldn't change it for anything in the world because it really prepared me for the world. And there are a lot of things that you go through at HBCUs that just get you ready for what real life is about.
Outstanding. Dee Todd, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Gil McGregor.
Okay.
And I hope nothing but the best for you.
Thank you so much. We've been entertained, informed, and we've just been thoroughly enlightened by having Dee Todd as our guest on today's podcast. You stay with us. You come back with us next week. We promise you we're going to have more exciting guests. And as Maya Angelou has always said, when you get, give. When you learn, teach. So join us next week on Black College Sports and Education Foundation's podcast. I've been your host, Gil McGregor. Good night.
Thank you for tuning into the podcast. For more information about us, please visit our website at www.bcsportsfoundation.com. Also, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at HBCU for Life. That's HBCU, the number 4, Life. To be a potential guest on our podcast, contact Ed J. Hayes at ed.j.hayes@gmail.com. Tune in next week for another amazing show.